Bob Dobbs with Gerd Stern, and this is part two of our long and in-depth interview with Gerd about his life. And this is June 29th, 2008. We're picking up from where we left off last week. Gerd, you say you found the oratorio, or what's not an oratorio, in your work with Marg Richter.
Marga Richter. And Marga, M-A-R-G-A. It was a cantata, not a oratory, or M, or whatever. But
what's
anyway,
a cantata?
I found the score for it.
What's a cantata, Gerd?
I don't know. It's music and words. You know, I read you the words last week, so
yes,
you know what they were. And they were set to music for a chorus and orchestra. Yeah, anyway. That's long ago in the past.
So you have quite an archive at your place? Actual, you know, documents and things?
Unfortunately, in some way, fortunately in another, I have boxes upon boxes of papers. I've got more audio tapes, like about 1,500.
Oh.
I've got slides up the kazoo, video, film. And of course, objects.
Did you offer that to Bancroft?
I haven't offered it to anybody. People are after it. Bancroft is after it. The Getty Research Institute is after it, and Stanford through Fred Turner is after it. But they all want a donation, and I'm not donating. And we're not donating. I mean, we include Michael Callahan, you know.
Yes.
But I'm determined that people are going to have to pay for it if they want it.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for being generous with the oral history.
It's not a question of generosity. It's a question of making a living. This happens to be probably the only or major asset that I have, and I'm going to be 80, and I'm living on not much more than Social Security these days. So,
right.
And that barely manages my mortgage.
Okay, so where is Jane Hill, your wife? She's pregnant in 51, according to my notes. Does she get pregnant in New York State, or when you move back out
in New York State.
Right. So is Adam born in New York State?
No, Adam is born after we get to California.
And how do you get out there? Do you hitchhike again, or do you drive?
No, we drive with another couple. Friends about Keith Carr and Barbara, whose last name I can't remember. And so we have a merry old cruise out to there. We failed one time before and had a hitchhike because we had an accident on the Pulaski Skyway.
Right. So how long does this trip take when you drive out? Is it 3 days or 2 weeks? Do you take your time and visit places?
No, I don't know. Neither one, you know, in between.
Right.
We go pretty direct. Everybody's in a hurry to get to California. But we don't drive day and night.
All right. So is First Poems and Others, your first publication, are you taking it with you out to San Francisco, or is it published out there or back in New York?
It was published in New York, I'm sure I took it wherever I went.
Okay, so you get out to San Francisco, and is this when you meet Kenneth Rex Ross and Robert Duncan, or have you already met them?
I think I met Duncan at the reading of Brother Antoninus, although it was William Everson still at the time, and Philip. I think Duncan was there. I think I get to meet Kenneth Rexroth on this next trip, yes.
Right. Now, in the Bancroft bio, you mentioned that there were two types of poets, I guess. There was the Politics of Chicago school, represented by Nelson Algren and Paul Goodman, and the non-Politics of Chicago school of Kenneth Rexroth and Robert Duncan. Can you elaborate on that?
I don't know if that's what I said. Maybe that's what I said, but I mean, Kenneth was very leftist, liberal, voluble person on the political scene, so I don't know why I would have said that. Duncan was from outside of Santa Cruz, so he wasn't anything to do with Chicago. Paul Goodman, I knew, from New York originally, and he was out in California, but I believe that was the second time I was there that I saw him.
And did you meet Nelson Algren, or you were just saying he was an example?
No, I was just saying he was an example.
Right. So you're living in Berkeley now when you get back there, right? You move into Berkeley.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was right away, but yeah, we were living right near the waterfront, Berkeley.
Right. And this is when you get into the jazz scene even more, in the Black Hawk Club?
No, that was later.
Oh, okay.
That was really... I mean, I was always into jazz, but when I got into the clubs and things, that was when I was already living on the board.
Okay, now, Kenneth Rexroth was...
I mean, you're collapsing things. In other words, so we're in Berkeley, but eventually we moved to San Francisco, and then eventually we moved to Mill Valley, and then from Mill Valley we moved to the Barge, and this is all with Jane.
Right. Now, I just wikied Kenneth Rexroth, and he's born in 1905, so he's considerably older than you. Has he established himself as a major poet by 1950?
Yes.
And so
he had a salon every weekend.
Right, but he says he was born in Indiana, so he ended up in San Francisco at some point in his life.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's been there quite a long time, and he was a major figure in the literary scene.
Including in the village. It does say he moved back to the Greenwich Village here and went to the new school.
Well, you mean before he came to San Francisco?
Yeah, was he recognized as a major poet before he dominated the San Francisco scene?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so that helped him carve out a place, which I remember you saying... Yeah, they say here he is regarded as a chief figure in the San Francisco Renaissance. And I could Google that or check that. It says it refers to... a hub of American poetic avant-garde. Others included Alan Watts and Ralph Gleason. So,
what is that? I mean, first of all, they weren't friends of Kenneth. They were friends of mine.
All right.
And they had nothing to do with that world, which was Kenneth's world, which had a lot to do with politics, local and regional and global, and poetics. Alan Watts was, erstwhile Anglican minister.
Yes.
Okay,
so does KPFA come in this period? And Lou Hill, when you hook up with...
Yes, but not in the Berkeley part of the period.
Right.
I started working at KPFA when we were living in Mill Valley. Yes, and I knew Lou and Dick and Eleanor and the other startup people, but I knew them through poetry.
Lou Hill was a poet or just a consumer?
Yes, he was a poet, and he was the guy who put Pacifica Foundation together.
Right. So when you get to Berkeley, or when you first get back there with Jane, and Jane's going to give birth to your first son, Adam, are you going around being a poet? Are you promoting your work, or are you looking for a job in something? What's your activity?
I'm usually got some kind of a lousy job.
Mm. But you're looking, you reconnect with the poetry scene, which is led, it seems, by Kenneth Rexroth at that point. You plug back into that scene.
Well he I wouldn't call him the leader. He had a salon, a weekly salon, which he hosted and which was known locally, nationally, and internationally. And any time somebody from the avant-garde would be coming to San Francisco, they would show up at his salon. There were several centers of poetry. There was the Poetry Center at San Francisco State University, which was run by Ruth Witz Diamant. And that they invited people like, you know, Dylan, who she supposedly had an affair with, maybe. I mean, I knew Dylan in New York.
And, Dylan Thomas? Did you say?
Yeah. Yeah, and Ted Rethke, and, you know, and I worked for her for a while. I mean, volunteer. And I hosted, when Ted Rethke came to town, you know, I took him around and showed him the town and spent time with him.
That's Theodore Roetke, R-O-E-T-H-K-E, I think. And you mentioned Dylan Thomas. Do you have anything to say, your experience with him in New York?
Yeah, it was just New York. It was mostly at the White Horse and at poetry readings. And he was ubiquitously drunk. And I remember being maybe one of four or five people to... not exactly carry, but, you know, physically steer him to where he was living at the time.
Right. Now, did you admire his poetry?
Yes, I did.
Did it have any kind of influence on you?
I don't know. No, I don't have his kind of lyrical gift, you know. I wouldn't want it, but he was great at what he did. It's not a style which you can fall into or even imitate. It's a very, you know, Welsh sing-song style.
Mm.
But force that through the green fuse, right? The flower drives my green age, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you know why he was a drunk? Do you have any insight into his personal...
At that time, I wasn't into, you know, psychological thinking.
Right.
You know, he was a drunk. You know, as I remember it, many years later, having more experiences with alcoholics, I started thinking about it. You know.
Yeah.
But not at that time.
Okay, so KPF, do you know the year that KPFA starts? You know, offhand.
No, I don't.
It says,
I remember before, but it was fairly early that it started.
Yeah, it says launched.
I wasn't associated with it when it started.
Yes, it's launched in 49.
Okay.
And it said the first interview with anyone from the gay political movement was broadcast by KPFA. As well as Ginsberg's groundbreaking poem Howl in the 1950s. So you're there in 52, 53, 54, I guess, working with Lou Hill.
Yeah, someplace in there, right.
So how did you become engineer of Alan Watts' broadcast?
I wasn't the engineer. I helped produce a lot of stuff because we didn't have a heavy-duty crew of employees, you know.
Yeah.
We had a chief engineer, and, you know, people produced programs in a kind of a, you know, hey, I'll take care of that kind of way sometimes. I mean, Lou Hill was on top of it all because he took, you know, every little bit very seriously. But I knew Grace Clements and I knew Alan, so, you know, whenever I... studio, and I was sitting in the control room, or sometimes in the studio room with them, you know.
Were you considered producer?
Yeah, well, that wasn't a big word in those days. It got to be a big word later on. You know, and I produced some programs of my own. And also, you know, I introduced the station to a lot of people, Jaime D'Angulo, probably Alan. Alan didn't know those people.
Well, how did you meet Alan Watts then, if you introduced KPFA to him?
Alan Watts, I met the same place I met Harry Parch, at the Onslow Fords in Mill Valley.
The what? I didn't catch that word.
The Jacqueline and Gordon Onslow Ford.
Onslow, yeah. O-N-S-L-O-W hyphen F-O-R-D, right? Onslow Ford. So, why did Watts know them, or why did they know Watts? What was the context?
You got me, babe. You know, I don't know why they... They were one of a group of wealthy arts lovers and arts... I mean, Gordon was a well-known painter who had worked with the Surrealists in Paris. He was a Brit.
Yeah.
He just died a couple of years ago, and he had a place on the coast as Inverness. And... So they had parties, and we were invited. Philip knew them from long ago. In fact, you know, it was my estimation that he had a big crush on Jacqueline, who was a beautiful woman. She was an heiress of a San Francisco family. And they had a marvelous house up on the hill in Mill Valley. And Gordon had the barge, not the barge, but the ferry boat, Vallejo, at Point 5 in Sausalito, which is where I wound up with my barge eventually.
When you said he had the ferry boat, you mean he owned them?
He owned a ferry boat, which was not running. It was used as a houseboat, and he had his studio on one end, and John, known as Yanko Varda, had the other end. And eventually, Alan Watts was living on Gordon's end of it.
Right. Now, when you encountered Alan parties, or these first times, how did he present himself? As a minister, or as just a...
He was already, into the bringing Asian lore to the American scene, right?
Mm. Did you find any stories about how his anecdotes, or how he talked about philosophy, or he didn't talk philosophy in party, or was he always on performing his Buddhism?
He was pretty often on. He also drank a lot.
Yeah, I heard about that.
He drank a lot, and there was a lot of drink around, and there were plenty of drugs around, so, you know.
And the drugs would be marijuana, and there would be peyote?
No, not so much. There'd be marijuana, and for other people, there'd be hard drugs in San Francisco, but, it was long before psychedelics.
Yeah.
And peyote wasn't a big number among that crowd. Now, George Late, who was in Oakland, published a poetry magazine, L-E-Y-T-E. He was into peyote with the Indians. In fact, he was the one who took me up. I think it was, on the way up to Nevada, where I had my first peyote experience.
You mean when you went to the mines? When you worked in the mines in Nevada? Is that what
No, it had nothing to do with that. It was... George Late was the next trip after that.
Right.
Or maybe even No, it's probably the one, the third trip. The Mayans was the first trip.
The Mayans?
Mayans, I suppose.
Oh, the Mayans. Yeah,
gold and silver mine.
Yes. So, it seems that Phil Lamont, how do you say his name? Phil Lamantia?
Lamantia.
He was making connections with these people while you were in New York in 49, 50, 51, probably, right?
He grew up in San Francisco.
So he met Alan Watts pretty early.
I don't think so. I think he met him at the Onslow Forge the same time I did.
Okay.
When I met Alan and his, at that time, wife, they had just arrived, practically, from England.
Yes. So the Doors of Perception come out at this time, 1954. Is that jumping ahead from what we're talking about, 52, 53? Or do you remember Alan Watts talking about it?
No, I don't remember Alan Watts talking about it. I don't remember very many people talking about it until a little bit later.
Were you aware of it when it came out in 54?
I don't think so.
Right. So then, working with the KPFA...
I mean, I knew Huxley's work, you know.
Yes. As a novelist.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Mill Valley, that's when you're working with KPFA. Does Lou Hill live in Mill Valley?
No. KPFA had nothing to do with Mill Valley.
I mean, when you were...
KPFA was headquartered on Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley, and Lou Hill lived in Duncan's Mills up on the Russian River.
And you were living in Mill... I meant it, that you were living in Mill Valley at that period,
yes,
when you got involved.
Throckmorton Street.
So when you say you go around and you know, lobby or whatever it is, solicit subscriptions to KPFA, how are you doing that? Is that driving up and down over miles, or are you going to particular centers of groups? How do you gather subscriptions for KPFA?
Okay. All right. It was a difficult time for FM because FM had just come in lately. So a lot of people didn't have FM sets. Now, I came onto the scene after KPFA was going for some time, and they had ways of getting to potential subscribers. You know, actual subscribers would have meetings in their communities and to play some of the programs for people and explain to them what the motive of the station was. So that was already done. When I was public relations director, my first thought was that how could the station succeed when a lot of people didn't have FM, you know? So eventually, through some connections that we made, we being Lou Hill and I, there was a Japanese company named Granco, G-R-A-N-C-O. They made a tiny FM radio and a tiny FM tuner, and we made a deal with them to buy 100 at a time, and we basically gave it to people who didn't have an FM radio if they subscribed at a certain level, which was, you know, but you got the radio too, and it was like $49 or something like that.
Yeah.
And you got the radio or the tuner. If you were a hi-fi person, you wanted the tuner, not the radio. And so we had, then in the communities all around down by the valley, you know, Monterey, North, Marin, and Oakland, we had antenna committees of volunteers who, if those people bought the subscription and the tuner or the radio, if they bought an antenna, this crew would mount it for them on their roof.
Okay.
You know, so that was very nice, and it worked. And I used to go down to places like Bakersfield and Modesto, Junior in the Valley, and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, we had to go around and, you know, help people, and it grew, you know, and it worked pretty well. We sold, I think, some hundreds. I remember we had to keep reordering those little brown buggers.
He said some hundreds, sold some hundreds.
Yes, hundreds, yeah.
Did you own a car at the time?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so a lot of it was on your own gas money.
I don't know, no. When I worked for the station, I got paid a salary and we got expenses. I wasn't a volunteer.
Right. I have my notes here. I have Mill Valley, KPFA, Hill, and Hutchins. Now, Hutchins, Robert Hutchins, helped the beginning of it, I guess? Or is that a later phase?
Yeah, he was around for quite a number of years, and he not only provided the funds for the transmitter, he provided funds for certain programming, like the poetry series that we did, where actually in the Billy Master, some of that is on there.
That's the disc you made, or the collage you made in the 60s, the Billy Master.
Yeah, but it used material, a lot of the material was stuff that I had worked on at KPFA.
Right. Now, you know, Robert Hutchins had some authoritative position at the University of Chicago in 46.
What do you mean, authoritative position? He was the president.
Right. I wasn't sure if he was president, but he was up there.
He was the first young person who, in the U.S., who became a big university president at that kind of age. And then eventually he moved to head the Ford Foundation.
Yeah, he was president, I'm looking it up, University of Chicago in 1929 to 45, and that means he was only 30 years old when he started as president.
That's right.
So in 46, 47, McLuhan visited him and presented this new improvement on the Great Books program. Do you remember the Great Books program, which was something?
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
I remember. What's his name?
Adler, I think it was Adler.
Yes.
Yeah, Adler and Hutchins proposed this in 46 or during the war or at the end of the war. And McLuhan,
I think they started when Hutchins was at the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Because Jay Mortimer Adler, right?
Yes. And McLuhan went down there to do it better, and they didn't hit it off. So that Hutchins knew McLuhan before, in a sense, had interacted with him. Not that you would have thought of him in the 50s, but if you had interacted with him, brought him McLuhan, you might have got an interesting reaction from him. That was latent.
Yeah, well, he was definitely our main source of financing.
Did you meet him yourself?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and he was he doing the Ford Foundation at that point?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's where the money came from, baby.
Yeah, he was chancellor of the University of Chicago from 45 to 51. So I guess he becomes involved with the Ford Foundation after that, you know, after 41,
well,
51.
You know, you say KPFA started in 49.
Yeah, that's what the...
But I don't know what happened in 49, whether there was actually a station on the air or whether it was the founding people, you know, Lou and Richard and Eleanor and a couple of other people who were meeting and planning to get it together, because, boy, the transmitter, now maybe they were originally working with a very weak signal, but by the time we put this transmitter, I wasn't working there yet, KPFA put the transmitter up on Mount Diablo, I think. It's right behind Berkeley. I used to have to go up there, and we used to have to shovel, and I had a radio operator's license. We all at the station had to have them, because there always had to be one person at the transmitter. You know, that was a regulation of the FCC, and we had to make certain tests every number of hours.
How many hours driving or whatever from Berkeley, the Berkeley address, was that tower?
30, 35 minutes.
Right.
That's just up the mountain.
Right.
Behind Berkeley.
Okay, now...
Maybe it wasn't Diablo, I don't remember.
Do you remember the Korean War in this period?
Not specifically, no. I mean, you know, we were KPFA, and we in general were always marching for peace. Then and later in New York and whatever, but I mean, they were all pacifists, you know. Lou was, during the war, he was an inspector with the Quakers of the conscience objector camps. He was a CO, but he didn't go to jail, like most of them did. And there were a lot of them around.
And so it was the core of people he knew in the Quaker movement that he motivated to do KPFA with?
No, I don't think so. Lou felt that the United States needed a tradition of communication, and radio was going to be the first move, and then newspapers, magazines, and then he was going to run for president.
Right. Did he get that idea for running for president during the war, when he was...
Who knows, but when I met him, he was already, like, heading in that direction.
Right. So the...
He was a good poet.
Right. Now, so you don't have too many images of that time in terms of the Korean War, which ends in 53, so you can't really time what's happening with that. I mean, do you remember the war ending? And where you were at that time?
No, I don't remember where I was. You know, I mean, I knew it ended when it ended, but I wasn't positioning myself for any reason.
Did you meet...
I remember at a certain point hearing of JFK's assassination when I was somewhere that I remember where I was.
Right.
But that just happens to be one incident. I usually don't remember things like that.
Okay, so you discuss in the oral history, Bancroft's oral history, the literary life was, quote, re-oralizing. You remember saying that?
Yes, people were reading live and reading with music. I did some poems with a bongo player, fairly well-known bongo player, Jack Costanza, and I did with a dancer, which is pictured in an old Life magazine. I mean, that's a story about that. Rex Ross doing jazz, and Larry Ferlinghetti, and me, and I can't remember who else.
And that is as early as 52, 53?
Got me.
Yeah, because it becomes popularized with the Beatnik movement, you know, 57 on.
I don't know. It was in the 50s. It wasn't in the 60s. That's
right.
For sure. I have a copy of it.
Of what?
Of the Life magazine with that story in it.
Maybe if you see it, we can get a date on that.
No. Yeah, I mean, I can get you a date because we've just put it on FileMaker Pro.
Okay. So did you meet Wallace Stevens?
No. I do not think I met him. I worked with Lou on that program with Wallace Stevens, and for some reason, at one point, I thought I'd met him, but I don't think I did. I think Lou went east to meet with him, and I didn't go with him.
Yeah, because I have a note here, Wallace Stevens, Watts, Ellen Watts, and Grace Clements. Grace Clements, you talk about her occasionally.
Yeah, Grace was a Jungian, and she had a garden in Richmond, and I worked for her in the garden, as a matter of fact. She paid me. She had some money. And she was a heavy-duty Jungian, and we were going to do a book together, which never got off the ground. It was she kept on talking about symbology, and I said to her one time, is there a book, a kind of an encyclopedia of symbols? And she said, no, there really should be. I said, why don't we do one? And so we wrote a proposal, which I also have as part of my archive. It never got anywhere. We talked to a lot of people about it. And some people were very hot on it, and other people said that's ridiculous.
Is it something that Joseph Campbell's known for doing later? Is that what you were thinking?
I don't know. I've read a lot of Joseph Campbell, but I don't know that he ever did a encyclopedia of symbols, did he?
Well, I guess it's just the Mass of God, all the religious icons. I'm thinking of them as symbol.
No, these were actually going to be, images of the various symbols used in all kinds of religious or social or political or scientific realms, with a description of what they are and what they meant. Probably came from thinking about mandalas.
Right. And have you ever seen one since
when,
then?
What?
A book of symbols like that.
No, I never have.
Okay, so the...
she had a weekly program on the station.
Right, and where is Richmond? I don't know Richmond.
Okay, Berkeley is, Oakland is on one side of Berkeley, and you could say Richmond is on the other side.
I see.
Of Berkeley. It goes up, if you were heading towards Sacramento, you would hit Richmond after Berkeley.
Okay, so when we bring up the theme of reoralizing, and you mentioned bongos and music, that's not oral as mouth, it's more oral as music.
No, it's people reading two things. I mean, I read my poetry while Jack played the bongos. I read my poetry while, I can't think of his name right now, was dancing. We didn't have music. Kenneth Rexroth read his poetry, which weren't written specially for this thing. He read his poetry to his jazz band.
Right. So it's mixed media.
Well, you want to think of it as that, as early mixed media, sure.
I mean, there always was people doing poetry, oral poetry readings, right, through the 20th and 19th centuries?
Well, yes, but it wasn't a big deal in San Francisco until we all started doing it,
Yeah.
I mean, we had, at the time I was married to Anne, living on the barge, now this is another period later, we had a group, and that was the time, really, of the oral stuff. No, not this time. You're early on here.
Yeah, you don't associate Jane, your marriage to Jane, with the oral period.
No, I mean, Jane knew Kenneth. I mean, we used to go there, but no, this was the later period when that life came out. I was with Anne on the barge.
Right.
And we had a group of poets called Seven Stray Cats. There were seven of us. Anne was one of them. I was one of them. Jack Gilbert, who's now fairly well known, was one of them. And, I still have we used to give readings in Berkeley and in San Francisco and in Marin County. And we issued a mimeograph, sheaf of poems. And on the front cover was silkscreen, the seven stray cats with an image of a cat. I have something. In fact, some guy who was Jack Gilbert's, he collects Jack Gilbert.
Archivist, maybe.
Maybe, but anyway, he worked for the FBI, actually, it turned out, which was very odd to me. But he called me up and he asked me if I had one of those, because he had bought one on eBay.
Yeah.
And he said he wanted a copy of the one from Sausalito. It turned out I had two copies from Sausalito. He paid $300 for it.
Mm.
He said that's what he paid on eBay, so he might as well pay it to me.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't pass it up, Amy.
Okay. So the I wonder, what is the texture of life in 53-54 in terms of people's clothing and the music? Was it changing from a 40s mood, or were you not aware of that, or were you, and was it different from the New York scene or even the Village scene?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by music. It's this period that is coming, we're coming to, that I'm working with Harry Parch talking about music.
Yes.
And we're going to jazz clubs, and the orchestra I get together for Harry, which was like at one point we needed about 30 people to do Oedipus. I recruit from the army band at the Presidio, and they're mostly jazz musicians who got into the band because they didn't have to go to war or anything, right?
Right. How did you meet Harry Parch?
At the Onslow Fords.
They knew him, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
He had just moved to Sausalito.
From where?
From where?
Another part of the country?
Another part of California.
Right, okay. So
you asked me the question, I'm going to answer it.
Okay.
From Lolita, which is up the coast on Highway 1.
So he was, is he a Californian by birth?
No, he was born to a, so his parents were they were ministers and missionaries in China.
Yeah, that's what it says here. It says he was born in Oakland, California in 1901, but he spent his childhood in Arizona, New Mexico.
That's right.
Now what...
Then he rode the rails.
Right. So when you meet him at Gordon's house, why do you guys team up? Are you just like what he's talking
about? He's talking about untempered scales. You know, I don't know from nothing, man.
Yeah.
I don't know that the reason my grandmother, as you may remember, was a concert pianist. The reasons that Western music developed was because they equalized the scale, right?
Right.
Do I know this? So now I'm fascinated, and he's talking about Greek monochords and 43 tone intervals, and you know, it was wild stuff for me. So I got to know him, and he needed help. He needed help, lots of help, and I became his manager, right? What do I know from managing, right? But I did a very good job of managing Harry Parch for some years.
Is this the same time you were selling the transmitters for KPFA?
Well, we were selling subscriptions.
Subscriptions at the same time?
Yes. Harry, I think, was a little earlier than...
Then your involvement with Blue Hill.
It was more or less the same time, yeah.
So while you're doing all this, you know, different activities, KPFA, Harry Parch, the poetry group, what does Jane think of this? Is she involved with this, with you?
Yeah, Jane is pretty involved. But by this time, we're living in kind of a semi-commune with a bass and guitar player named Buck Weeds, David Weeds. And with a couple naming names, Bill and Pam Loughborough. He was working as an electronics technician at the Navy Yard, and she was trying to get pregnant. And then we moved to the barge, but that's a story all by itself, you know. from Mill Valley, all five of us.
Right. There was, if I recall, the whole enterprise of moving the barge was it?
Well, that was moving the barge was one thing, but getting the barge. So I'm sitting in the Tin Angel, which is a bar, no longer extant, in Sausalito, which is owned by Peggy Tope Watkins, who was from Black Mountain days.
Yeah.
I didn't really know her at Black Mountain, but the fact that I'd been there was, she was a militant lesbian. And she had this great bar, and there were a few great bars, because Sally Stanford had her place in Sausalito, too. But I'm in the bar one day, and I hear Peggy talking to Blanche Sherwood, who's a sculptor, and saying, if you don't get rid of that damn fucking barge, I don't want anything more to do with you. You keep talking about it, and it's sitting there in our shipyard, and it's eating up all your money. Just give it away to somebody. And now, this is totally amazing, because about 2 weeks before, and I had been working for Harry already quite vigorously, Gordon Onslow Ford called me and asked me to meet him on the Vallejo. And he said he wanted to give me something. He was so touched by what I had been doing for Harry and how things were coming together that he wanted to give me something. And I was thinking, oh, wow, maybe a check, right? No. He gave me a berth for a barge on his land. Now,
you don't have a barge. You don't have a barge, but he gives you a berth for one.
No, I don't not only not have one, but I don't even know about barges or anything, But it's a berth for a boat or a barge or anything that I want to live on, So, all right. So here, I listen to this conversation, and I say, hey, you want to give me the barge? I'll take it. And Peggy looks at me, she says, don't be crazy, Garrett. It's a white elephant. You'll never be able to get it out of Don once. I knew Don Arquez. He's a Portuguese shipyard owner there in Sausalito. She said, you'll never get it out of there, and you've got to get it out of there. And it's 130 foot long and 35 foot wide, and it's got a house on it. So I say, don't discourage me, I'll take it. So a couple of days later, the bill of sale is drawn up for $1, and I get this barge, right? I go to see Donald and Arquez, and he says, Onslow Ford gave you a place to put that thing? I say, yeah. He says, that's really remarkable. He said, you're going to have a lot of trouble getting it up there, but I'll help you. And that's a business that I really know. So the barge has tremendous leaks, right? And you have to get rid of all the water, and it's below the deck, which the house is standing on. Below the deck, there's about 5.5 feet, so you can't really stand up in it. You got to, scrunch yourself. And there are leaks between the timbers, so we use old mattresses, we use cement, you wouldn't believe what we use. And as a no-name bar, which is the bar in Sausalito for the literary crowd, right?
Yes.
They're making bets on whether I can raise the barge or not. And the people who are on my side are volunteering to help me. So you got to get it ready for the big tide of the month, right? And we work like hell, and then Donlin puts these huge pumps in and he expects the barge to rise off the mud, right? It's stuck on the mud.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't come off. So everybody's really discouraged. And Arquette says to me, all right, you didn't do it this month, you'll do it next month. You know? So again, we work our asses off, and we work, and we put pumps on the high tide. And I'm down below fixing the last leaks and making sure that the pumps are working. And there's this enormous crash, like heavy thunder, right?
Yeah.
And I feel this sudden motion. And they're calling down through the hatch to me, Pierre, are you okay? You know, they think I'm dead or something. And the barge has popped up off the mud and is floating. And Donlan quits the pumps and he tugs us to the site on Gordon Lonsdale Ford's land. And I say to him, what was that enormous noise? And Donlan says, I have no idea. He says, hey, here we are, you know, where you want to be, huh? He hardly charges me anything because he thinks it's a great adventure. And also, he gets rid of the 130-foot barge, which is, you know, in his yard.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, at the next really low tide, we go to look at where the barge was, and the whole bottom planking of the barge is on the mud, and the nails are sticking up out of the bottom. So what that sound was the nails being drawn out by the flotation of the barge. It left the whole planking there, you know.
And the planking, you still have a bottom for the boat. The planking was something added to the bottom?
The planking is the very bottom, but on the other side of the planking are these huge beams with oakum, you know, stuff between them. You know, oakum is that kind of brown, hairy stuff that they use in boats.
Yeah.
Between. Yeah. So, anyway, so that was that.
So it's like...
We moved onto the barge.
Now, do you have a sense of when that was? Is this after the Korean War is over, or... Or what else in your life you put together with that, timing-wise?
I don't know. I mean, we were doing plectrum percussion dances and starting to work on Oedipus. And I was...
What was Oedipus? You mentioned... Oh, that's with Harry Parch, right.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember is... well...
Jane is still with you.
Oh, yeah. Jane moves on to the barge. Yes. We haven't had the... She may be pregnant again.
With Radha?
Radha, right.
And do you know when she was born? How many years younger than Adam, who was born in 51?
I'll find out for you, but, I don't keep dates in my head.
But a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, right? So we're getting into 53, 54. Now, when I was asking about the music and texture of life, do you remember Doris Day and that kind of music before rock and roll comes in 55?
Sure, but, you know, I remember other people better than I remember Doris Day. I remember even Frank Sinatra, but I remember Bird and, Dizzy and Dixieland and... Ted Baker, I met at the time we had the barge.
Right, but these are what we call them fringe arts. The mainstream is not hearing Charlie Parker.
They weren't fringe arts to us.
No, not to you, but to the mainstream of Eisenhower culture, the people, I don't know what they were, they weren't listening to Charlie Parker, were they?
I guess not, but no. I mean, we were, but they were listening. You know, we also listened to Frank Sinatra and Chris. All the big orchestras, Woody Herman, Sam Kenton, Tito Puente.
What about movies? You have Marlon Brando start showing up around 53.
Yeah, we didn't do much movies, but we went once in a while, but we didn't do a lot of movies.
When you mentioned the phrase militant lesbian, that certainly is underground culture, the way we think of the 50s. I mean, how does one encounter a militant lesbian in 50s America in the images you get through Time and Life? You don't get that. But what's it mean to...
She was a tomboy.
Right, but what's a militant lesbian?
Hey, she talks about it all the time.
Ah, like a fanatic. I mean, she's not...
Yeah.
She's not going... She's not a warrior or someone who...
Well, she was kind of a warrior. And eventually, she opened the place in San Francisco, which didn't last very long, but she was a... You know, she was a very dyke girl.
Her name was Peggy? Is that... I got the right...
Peggy Tuck Watkins, yes.
Is she still alive? Probably not.
I doubt it.
Okay, so now you get on the barge, and that is no expenses, no rent. What expenses do you have on it?
Well, we have utilities, and we have food, and, you know, the usual stuff.
So does that... Go ahead.
And Buckwheat is working on the president line in the band, so he's on and off because he's... They go to, you know, the Philippines and then Japan and then they come back.
You mean a cruise ship? President's Line is a cruise ship?
No, I think it was they took passengers and they took freight.
Right. Now, what does it mean to be in a commune at that time? You say you kind of happened.
It wasn't very usual for five people to live together, right? And sometimes there were six or seven or us.
Did you say it was unusual?
It was unusual, sure.
Are people sexually...
Because communes came in later, you know.
Yeah, in the hippie culture. But are people sexually exchanging partners or
no.
monogamous within it?
Absolutely not.
Right. But just the idea of it's not a nuclear family structure is what's unique about it.
It's an extended family. Yes.
Right. So... how does the barge change your life, if you can say? I mean, does it bring in a whole... You do start having jazz people drop in, right?
Yeah, we have all kinds of people drop in. Alan, I have a picture of us with Allen Ginsberg and a few other people on the barge. You know, a lot of poets and artists. And Sausalito was full of artists.
Right. Is Alan Watts on his... Gordon Onslow boat at that time?
No, I think he was still living in Mill Valley. He and his wife, eventually they parted. I don't remember the whole story, but his wife, you know, he had been an Anglican clergyman, and he ran off with the head guy in the church is called. I mean, in that particular place they were with his daughter. And that was his daughter that he was married to.
Was that in England or in Chicago? I think he taught on the East Coast when he first came from England.
I don't know. That was in England.
Yeah.
Where she came from.
So that's who
but
you...
Anyway, they lived in Mill Valley, and then eventually there was a place on Mount Tamalpais which was owned by Roger Summers. And Alan lived out there, and there were a couple of other people. There were a few houses on the property, and he spent time there and on the Vallejo. But at the time, I think he was still living in Mill Valley, and he was, you know, the productions at KPFA of his started somewhere around that time.
Roger Summers or Watts?
Watts.
Why did you mention Roger Summers?
Because that's where Alan had a place to live for a long time.
Oh, I see. So was Alan Watts a real phenomenon once he got on the radio? Was this really charismatic?
Well, he was a very charismatic type, you know, both his behavior and his voice. He had a voice which had a kind of a magic to it. The tapes are still selling.
Yeah.
They happen to be the possession, I don't know how he got them, of a guy named Sandy Jacobs, who succeeded me at KPFA, actually.
Yeah, I know him as Henry Jacobs. I read an article on him. He did something interesting in the arts in Sesame Street for adults in the 70s. He's kind of being looked at and celebrated his life, this Henry Jacobs guy.
He's still alive.
Yeah, this interview was just a year or so ago I read.
He wasn't a nice guy.
In what way wasn't he a nice guy?
Pushy. Mm-hmm. Self-promoting. He used to take out Ann Hill.
London.
Ann London Stern, yes. Before me. And a few years ago, he called me about something else, and he said, you know, I have so much to thank you for in my life. And I said, oh, really, Sandy? He said, yes, you took Ann off my hands. That was hardly, he said, and that's how come I met my wife. He was married to a Japanese. I think she said.
You said he's married to who?
A Japanese woman. Was.
Yeah.
But that, after Ann, he found her. And he said that was the best thing that ever happened.